Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dominic Fifield of The Guardian and David Walker of The Daily Mirror. The world is against Jose Mourinho, apparently. United are victimised. They play too many matches and pick up too many injuries. He needs to spend another £200 million. Now, it's Europa League week. He will probably win 2 trophies this season. So what's there to complain about, Dom?
There's always something to complain about if you're Jose Mourinho. We've had it all before. We had it at Chelsea in his first season back at the club in the second spell when they got to the semi-finals of the Champions League and there was a fixture congestion at the end of the season. They went to Anfield with a shadow team and won 2-0 in the Steven Gerrard game. And then Atletico Madrid overcame them over 2 legs. It's that's what he does. I mean, it is freakish, the number of injuries they're getting, and to key players as well. But it's just what happens. Mm. It's an onerous fixture schedule, but it's the type of schedule you get if you're successful.
Well, you know, 9 games in 30 days. He's complaining about that. In 15 of the last 20 seasons, they've actually played more, you know, with greater intensity.
But don't you think, Mike, fundamentally, it's Jose creating the siege mentality that he loves and that he basically works off, be it in his dealings with the media, the message he passes out to the fans, how tough it is for him, and to a degree, the way he deals with the dressing room. I think the dressing room thing's been slightly become a problem for him in the last few months because of the issue over, for instance, the Phil Jones. At one point, Phil Jones was getting hero grams as being one of the key reasons for turning the season round, the stability they had at the back. And then that flips to, well, when is he going to play again? If he really is keen, he should be putting himself up for selection. And obviously the bigger one that has been a player who's got repeatedly kicked in the proverbials is poor old Luke Shaw, who I know internally there are people in the dressing room saying, hang on, how far can you push a poor lad like that? If you don't fancy him, do the decent thing and sell him, but don't keep kicking him when he has clearly had problems.
And, you know, the news today is that Luke Shaw's got ligament damage in his foot, so he's not putting it on. There's a lot of sympathy for him. And does this actually sort of bring out the fact that Mourinho may be a little bit slipping out of his own time in terms of... Most modern managers are emotionally intelligent. They're quite smart in the way that they deal with modern squads. Is he too much of a blunt instrument?
I wouldn't go that far. This is just the way he works, and it's proved successful at every club he's been at. And, you know, as you say, they could walk away from this season with 2 trophies. And I suspect that this time next year we will see a Manchester United team competing strongly for the Premier League title, albeit it may be after another £200 million has been spent. Mm. I just get the impression with Jose that often when he comes into a club, certainly second time at Chelsea, it took him a while just to gauge what he'd inherited, where the adjustments needed to be made, lavish adjustments. These were similar criticisms that he was issuing to Samuel Eto'o, who was a big ally of his from his days at Inter, to Fernando Torres when he was there second time around. I mean, he was scathing of the lack of forwards he had at Chelsea. And he's doing it now with players that may be a bit more fragile, slightly more vulnerable potentially. I mean, we all know what Luke Shaw's gone through in the last 2 years with his injuries. So maybe it does sound a bit unfair, but the reality is he's testing them. And if they come through those tests, they will be mainstays for Jose Mourinho's Manchester United team. If they don't, they'll move on.
I think just one thing to add on that, and where it's culturally different is, I know from my time covering United and dealing with Sir Alex Ferguson on a daily basis, there were times when he made a call or had decided somebody was expendable, but the time wasn't right, and he had to get something out of them or even to keep them with a market value on them. So even though he knew, and I can remember with one player, it was 2 years from him deciding and the actual exit coming, mm-hmm. but he never went into the, you know, with the disdain of Mourinho of putting people down, almost to keep the market value high and to shift him on, even though he knew that's what he wanted to
do. So there's greater subtlety in his squad management then?
Yeah, without doubt. You can be. I mean, if you look at it now, look at a great example, mate. Look at Wayne Rooney. It appeared that Jose was backing him publicly in every way as he was going towards the England goal-scoring record and the Manchester United goal-scoring record. And he kept reiterating, he is my captain, etc. When he knew that those achievements had been reached, he just bombed Rooney. Now, at that point, remember, and Mourinho didn't deny this, there was still the chance to the end of February, when the Chinese window closed, for Rooney to be sold there. If you look at what's happened since that window closed and the way Rooney's been picked or, more to the point, not picked and just completely frozen out, the value of Wayne Rooney from being, oh, you might get your money back to a Chinese club and he's going to get a deal that's going to make him want to go, his marketability is sinking by the week, you know, literally. And that's partly because of the way he's been managed.
But the flip side of that is that if he had allowed Wayne Rooney to leave, and then he'd seen Zlatan go down with his knee injury, he would have had another player absent for what will be a critical run-in. And he needs them. He needs all these bodies at the moment, the way people are dropping like flies.
Yeah, I see today again, Raiola, Ibrahimovic's agent, is saying that Zlatan's going to be fine and he'll come back good as new, which he would say, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
That has thrown the spotlight on Marcus Rashford. A lot of discussion about the dive. To me, that basically gives us the clearest possible indication yet, over this weekend, that people don't really trust the referees to make the right decision. Is it time for video assistant referees?
Well, yeah, it is time, because of the level of scrutiny that each decision is coming under now. It was a bad weekend. I don't think it hasn't been like that every weekend. It's just sometimes you have these weekends where there are three or four incidents. I was at the Watford game on Monday night, and Lucas Leiva got booked for diving in the box. Rashford was simulation. Leroy Sané, and the common denominator between Sané and Rashford was that the referee was in a poor position to see either decision, and yet he's given a penalty each time, which to me is surprising.
I don't even remember this, two seasons ago, the Dutch Eredivisie did the experiment with, and it was done secretly at the time, they only released the footage afterwards, where they had video refereeing going on and an earpiece for the referee to be told what the call was. People at the games didn't realise what was happening. Nobody knew it was happening. Mm-hmm. But do you know the weirdest thing was? Commentators at match said, haven't we got some great refs and never getting anything wrong? You know, because every marginal offside, the thing about that is offside because of the camera. So it wasn't a case of stopping the game and, oh, let's go up to the studio now. So I think in the long run, Mike, that will come. I've got to say, if we have a reluctance to do that, we currently have a review system mainly over acts of violence that the referee... I think we should now look at acts of simulation that the referees missed and retrospectively punish them to help stamp it out.
Because it is poisoning the atmosphere, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Know, because even with Rashford, you know, people are calling him a cheat. Well, that's a very strong word to use, isn't it?
It is, but I don't think we should be afraid to use it. Mm. I mean, look at the... say Swansea City go down and they have been cheated out of points in that game. By a decision that went against them that shouldn't have gone against them. I don't think we should worry too much about the words being used, because I think people are playing for decisions. I don't think Rashford's a criminal offence. I mean, he doesn't do it very often. I don't remember other incidents.
No, and I think, do you recall when Glenn Hoddle was the England manager and he brought into the debate, so you're back in the 90s, this about if somebody touches you, you feel the contact. Yeah. He was telling England players, go down, because that's what the Continentals will do. So, I mean, I think it's something that's probably evolved over the last 20 years, and somebody like Rashford's probably come up within that system. my point is, if you are going to stop it, there is only one way. It's no good sending a memo out to tell your players to stop. It's then if Rashford was to miss the next three games, he's likely to stop doing it.
The danger we've got is, I think you need an instant decision. You've got to have someone look, as you say, the video assistant referee has to look at it, make a decision then, because it's absolutely no odds to Swansea City if Rashford now gets a three-match ban. In fact, looking at it, if Rashford misses the Palace game at the end of the season, it actually works against Swansea City again, potentially. So, I mean, and same for Middlesbrough with Sane. If somebody's making an instant decision, that was a penalty or that wasn't, then fair enough. But the caveat on that is there are times when you slow down these incidents, when they look so much worse than they actually are. These people are running at full pelt into the box, and maybe they're touching. We're not ones to judge, any of us. If you're doing it at that pace, maybe a touch does knock you flying.
Let's go into football matters, funny enough. As I said, Europa League week, United are in Spain, Celta Vigo. On paper, looks a pretty manageable task.
Yeah, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a scout over in Spain, and he said the best comparison he could make, and I will qualify this, Celta Vigo are virtually a poor man's Atletico Madrid in that the unit, and they are one of the rare sort of middle-ranking Spanish teams where they really have a team spirit and get at you, which is similar to what Atletico Madrid do, but they're nowhere near as good as Atletico Madrid. And funnily enough, the guy who's seen as their talisman is John Guidetti, who, of course, spent time and didn't quite make it at Manchester City, had a terrible viral illness when he was over at Feyenoord and was out for 18 months. And I think it was sort of Ronald Koeman time when he gradually came back there and is now seen as the sort of kingpin of a Celta Vigo team, who will not lie down or start fracturing as we've seen certain other teams from that area in the past if United get on top of them. They all stick at it and they are a sort of gritty, determined team from a league that's a quality league at the very top, and we'll now see, it will be a good judge to see, can Manchester United sweep aside, you know, a middle-ranking Spanish team, as they really should.
And, yeah, and the form is poor, isn't it? You know, Celta have lost five out of the last six games in La Liga. And, you know, they are dealing with, you know, with greatest respect, almost second-class players in terms of, right, Guidetto didn't quite make it. Iago Aspas, exactly the same, didn't make it at Liverpool.
I don't think we could judge too much on their league performances. That they're a club who would freely admit that once they were safe, they prioritised the Europa League and they've got into uncharted territory on that. The league is not a priority for them, and the Europa League is. And it's the strength of the collective that has got them this far. And you can see this tie becoming a real grind because, with the great respect, United don't sweep teams aside in the Premier League or in Europe anymore. It's the way things have gone and with the injuries, they have to grind out results and hope that little flash of quality sees them through.
And the same thing goes in Spain with the Sevilla success in recent years, where, again, they were never really seen as going to break into the top two or three and win La Liga. But look what they did in Europe. This is almost the Celta Vigo. That's what we're aiming for now. And Manchester United are obviously seen as a massive scalp for them if that gritty, determined unit can pull off another couple of results for them.
The other semi-final, David, Ajax and Lyon. Ajax, I think it's 9 players of 21 or under.
Absolutely.
A club which is almost reverting back to type.
They have had what they describe as a velvet revolution in that they won 4 league titles under Frank de Boer, missed the 5th on the final day of the season, and the fans said the football was boring, they didn't want it, they wanted something more exciting. So they looked at this, they spoke to Jordi Cruyff, and Jordi Cruyff brought in from Israel the coach he had taken there, a guy called Peter Voss, and Peter Voss has overseen this revolution. So the old Ajax exciting, entertaining football, the 5-second rule where if they lose the ball, they've got to get it back in front. All those things are happening with this team of incredibly young players. The place is getting packed out every week because it's exactly as they want Ajax to play, and they've reached the semi-finals of the Europa League playing that way. Now, I mean, you've got a boy, Matthijs de Ligt, at centre-back. He's 17. Now, they played him in the national team and substituted him at half-time, and they do accept there's a limit to him, say, playing 3 times in 7 days. But you've got the talent, and I'm told the biggest teams from all over the world now are currently following Ajax everywhere, such as the talent within that team. And there is a boy, a blonde Dutch midfielder, Donny van der Beek, who is absolutely superb. And you see that the blueprint that Cruyff set of what they want to play is how they're doing it now. And even if it goes wrong, they're not going to panic, you know, because they're second in the league and it's likely Feyenoord will win it. But they've got the principles right. Mm. And I am told they've still got £120 million in the bank. So they're not. It's not a we need to go out. They will buy, and they'll buy big at 9, 10, 12 million pounds, normally in South America. But they do not have any intention of squandering that on massive European signings.
Yeah, Dom, you're off to Monaco for the Champions League semi-final against Juventus. Do you see any parallels between Monaco and Ajax in terms of that belief in youth?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, it has taken a while for Monaco to get to this stage, and a lot of these players have been picked up. They're not necessarily generated within. Some of them are. I mean, Mbappe's the one that everybody raves about, and there are others.
Bernardo, justifiably, by the way.
Absolutely. Yeah. What a phenomenon he is. But I can see why everybody loves watching them. They're just incredible as an attacking force. And even when you've got, you know, fullbacks like Mendy and Mendy bombing forward. Mendy, incidentally, is... His performances veer from the sublime to the ridiculous. I mean, he's not the finished article. These guys are still quite raw. But what they've achieved in France this season, they look as if they're going to win Ligue 1, which is an incredible, incredible achievement. Even, you know, at a club that's backed by an oligarch, it's still incredible to pit Paris Saint-Germain to that. They're streets ahead of the other sort of traditional contenders, people like Lyon, you mentioned against Ajax, they're 20 points off third. They've got 57 points, and Nice are in there in between. So there's a lot going right at Monaco, and the worry is this may be their one opportunity, because although they may not need to sell in the summer, the vultures are circling. These guys will potentially be lured away.
Yeah, and with Juventus, David, it's almost, you know, the same problem that it's almost their last chance with this group of players, you know, with the Buffons and
Giulini. Oh, absolutely. But don't you see, Mike? I mean, you know, we saw Monaco playing against Manchester City and knocking them out. And you've seen them through this season. And they are thrilling to watch. Yeah. But there's this game of, you know, they're going to score, but you know they're going to let somebody in. And it's almost like, and then they meet Juventus.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. And then the real brutal. Yeah. And then Juve, as we saw in the last round, they bring an art form to defending, and a lot of players, and I say this, you see it in the Premier League, where mistakes are made, and you know, you hear pundits saying, oh, I can't believe he did that. You don't get that watching Juventus. You don't get that with the communication they've got. And
there's way a terrible beauty about the
absolutely.
Way they defend, isn't there?
And honestly, I remember being at the Champions League final, was it about 2002 at Old Trafford, they ended 0-0 Juve against Milan. No, but you were watching that and you saw the, you know, and it was real quality of the football and defending as an art form that we just don't see. And that's what this Juventus team have got. Now, if Monaco can start ripping them to shreds and counter-attacking, it will be fantastic to watch. I've got an awful feeling it's almost like, and then I woke up and the dream is over.
Yeah, talking of dreams, Atletico Madrid are in the same situation where, you know, it is a matter of time before Simeone moves on, Godin is snapped up, Griezmann comes either to Manchester or across the road into Real Madrid. Can they reach the final for the third time in 4 years?
Yeah, of course. Of course they can. They're streetwise. They've got everything about Simeone. He is that team, and the team's built in his image. And that's a toss-up between Juventus and Atletico Madrid as to who Real didn't want to play. And I think possibly against local rivals, a team that knows them from La Liga, I think this is a horrible tie for Real. You can easily see a Juventus Atletico Madrid final. And in fairness, that would actually, although it may not be the expansive football that you might get from Real versus Monaco, it would be a fitting final, the Simeone against the old school Juve.
I must say, I was alarmed watching the El Clasico a couple of Saturdays ago when you had the game tied, Real Madrid down to 10 men, they're losing 2-1, and they get it back to 2-2 with a few minutes to go. And they've got a three-point advantage, so the draw's fine. Yeah. And they're playing out that's it, that'll do us. Yeah. And yet there was still this sort of bugle being blown and the cavalry were charging. And you thought, this is going to end in tears, fellas. And yet they didn't seem to be able to see out the game at that point. Mm. And you just thought, if that had been an Atletico Madrid game, Simeone would have been so cute to take the draw, take the three-point lead, we will grind out the league. And that's the one thing I still think Simeone can do against Zidane, that he has that street toughness to kill a game if he needs to, and that Real Madrid is still full of this great flamboyance that sometimes can be their undoing. And it was that day.
What about the almost the eternal attractiveness of playing for Real Madrid in terms of their recruitment? Now, there are some sources who say that David De Gea won't be going, but there is also, at Chelsea, a real fear and a feeling that we could be in summer saga territory with Eden Hazard and going to Real Madrid. What do you think will happen there, Dom?
Well, I was convinced that there was absolutely no chance of Eden Hazard going to Real this summer until Antonio Conte was more publicly cautious on the matter last Friday. And he had an opportunity there to say to guarantee that Chelsea would knock away any bid from Real. And yet he basically said, well, look, it's up to the player. The player's will has to come into this somewhere. Now, I think that Hazard is settled at the moment. He's got a young family. He's happy where he is. He's playing wonderful football. He's in a team that's got a Premier League title to win in the next few weeks, and then they want to target the Champions League next year. And I would be amazed if he opted to sever ties with Chelsea this summer. But at some point in the future, Eden Hazard will be at Real Madrid.
There's a lot of noise about transfers, inevitably given the money that's floating around. You know, we can play transfer bingo with six players are going to go United, seven players are going to go to City. Does all that noise, all that speculation, sum up one thing? That maybe those outside the top two haven't done as good a job as they could have done.
Yeah, and I've got to say, even the top two, if you look what's left in the Champions League, you're in the relative stakes, if we're making the comparison between the potential champions, and you're putting Chelsea, I think, are going to win it, but you say Chelsea and Tottenham there, and you say, well, hang on, what happened when they were playing in Europe? Where are we on a long run of seasons now? You know, the years of any English dominance are well gone. So I think it's a bigger picture. I still think the other thing, Mike, is if you look at it, Champions League has become such an attraction to international players. Can you imagine someone like David De Gea, if he's not in the Champions League next season, reflecting on where he stands if Real Madrid are knocking? Real Madrid might have won the Champions League again. It suddenly becomes a different picture, doesn't it? Mm. So I do think we need our best clubs to be up there. And if you look at it at the moment, there isn't a lot of prospect of that happening in the immediate future.
I think Chelsea will offer a proper threat in the Champions League next year. I think they'll invest this summer and add. And I think one of the reasons that they've done so well this season is that they haven't had European football to worry about. I think next year, if Conte is still there, which I think he will be...
There's a lot of talk again about Inter Milan,
isn't
there?
Inter's just... I mean, it's just been bubbling along for a while. And until Conte actually formally signs the contract extension, it will carry on and the noises will come out of Italy, because there's got to be an ambition at a club that's just been bought by Chinese owners in Inter who want to make a splash next season. But next year, I'd fully anticipate Chelsea carrying the flag in the Champions League for England. Leicester did a wonderful job this year. Spurs underachieved, but then probably to the benefit of their league form now. And City, if I'm honest, have just been a massive disappointment all season in all competitions.
Mm. What about Lukaku? There's a lot on social media about him spending 5 minutes talking to Michael Emanalo in the tunnel. Is he of the requisite quality for a team which has ambitions to win the Champions League?
I think he is of a very similar style in the sense of the power, pace, etc. of Diego Costa. You do believe he's going to be out the door now, and whether they would have him as part of that, one of the strikers they'd want to look at. The amount of money Everton are going to demand, because he's still got 2 years on his contract, will be a huge amount. But the vibes coming out of Everton are, I mean, remember last year we got the same thing, that he wanted to go back and Chelsea were going to get him and Everton held firm and said no. You do wonder if the right amount, and the claim is around £80 million. I'm not sure he's worth that, Mike, but you could see him getting into there. Does he take him up a league beyond Diego Costa? I don't think so.
I can't see. They're not buying the finished article, are they? I mean, it's his goal scoring, it's been superb, but in terms of the work rate that Costa puts into the team and the sort of unsettling that he does of opposing defences. Not always, in a bit of an underhand way sometimes, but he does a tremendous job for them. And taking that out of the team and putting Lukaku in, I don't think that's a direct replacement.
And what about Van Dijk?
Yeah, I think that's I think that will happen. I think that is John Terry is on his way, obviously, and they obviously need to reinforce their... it would offer them options in terms of where Azpilicueta plays. Potentially he could go to right wing back if needed, which would be an upgrade defensively on Victor Moses. Van Dijk is a great player, and I think it makes sense for Andreas Christensen to go to Southampton as part of a deal, possibly on a 2-year loan or something like that, to gain some Premier League experience.
You can bet he's going to go for centre backs with pace.
Yeah.
Who, obviously, big lads who can head it, but have got the pace to play in that three. But the other thing that struck me was, as of 2 weeks ago, Azpilicueta had the most success as a passer in the whole of the Premier League.
Yeah.
Him having the ball, he was more accurate than any other player. And you're thinking, God, what a quality to have for a player coming out from the back or playing in a wide area. That is quality.
If you think what Chelsea have achieved this season so far, and on the basis that they probably are going to win the Premier League, they then go and add Lukaku plus one other striker, I'd imagine, up top, Diego Costa on his way. Say Bakayoko in midfield from Monaco and Van Dijk at the back. That's pretty awesome. That's a spine of a team that's going to dominate.
And you've got Gary Cahill sort of almost growing into that leader, legend, JT role.
I'm not sure he's quite there yet, but he's doing fine. And again, if you're looking at options in your centre, he's a steady Eddie who's in there, isn't he? You'd have him in there. And I've got to say, David Luiz has defied all my fears about what might go wrong with him. By and large, he's been impeccable, and the system suits his play as well.
Mm. Do you expect Spurs to keep the pressure on Chelsea? Do you think they'll cut that lead to 1 point on Friday night against West Ham?
Yes. It was a massive test for them Sunday, just as it was in midweek at Palace. And they've come up with answers each time. There's nothing to say that their momentum is going to grind to a halt. Well, albeit, I remember this time last year, or maybe a bit earlier, when they were chasing Leicester, they went to West Ham and lost 1-0 to an early goal. But that was in the bowling. It was a different kind of atmosphere, different scenario. I think that West Ham are meandering at the moment. It might get their juices flying to play against Tottenham.
And let's be honest, Tottenham have answered a huge question because they blew up last year.
That is
a fact. It wasn't... There were a couple... After April and the setbacks they had with a couple of games and there was a semi or whatever, suddenly it all started going belly up and they'd hit the wall. And you've got to say the sign at the moment are very positive.
Yes.
Very. Mm. And I know last year there were claims... Pochettino's response to some setbacks with double training sessions and people complaining they'd left their legs on the training ground. Whatever they're doing this year and whatever the regime, he appears to have learned from it and be getting it right.
Yeah, the big picture strategy seems to be right. Now, money is secondary to a culture, enthusiasm and this sense of togetherness and unity.
I agree. I think the philosophy is admirable and has worked up to now. I do... worry a bit about Spurs in the future because I think at some point money does become an issue. And
Arsene Wenger said the same thing, didn't he?
Right, exactly. And if you've got a wage structure that strict where people like Kane, Walker, Rose, Eriksen, Ali can only really earn 75 grand a week, but 75 grand a week, and yet there are clubs in the same division who are willing to offer you four times that amount, I think ultimately it does break up. So there are massive questions for Daniel Levy to answer.
Correct.
And whether he's able to, whether he'd be willing to.
I think the Daniel situation, Daniel has always run a tight ship there. And let's be candid, some star players you knew inevitably the day would come and he couldn't resist a deal. He's a deal maker. Now, you add to that the new stadium, the cost of building. And, I remember the days of Arsenal and Arsenal saying, the Emirates Stadium's not taking anything away from the team and we can manage that. And then in retrospect, they said, well, actually, we've had to stick with this because so much was being affected. We had to shape the team and the spending, etc., around the commitment we had. Now, Tottenham insist, I take it at face value, the stadium's not going to affect the team. Well, let's just see where they are. So over a 3-year period, and if Dele Alli, Harry Kane, Al are still there and the building on it, because I know Tottenham fans who have that deep down fear that the tradition at the club is at a point they cash in. And that's what I think would eventually drive Pochettino away.
It looks like Walker's going to go to City for about 50 million. Kevin Trippier has actually made that decision a lot easier for Spurs, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's done well, yeah. I mean, it's,
there's also a murmur about Toby Alderweireld and his contract talks, and they're stalling over a release fee.
But that's going to be the issue. And we've had this succession of pictures of Pochettino in a suit signing a new contract.
And, around the shoulder, yeah.
And that looks great because you're all signing these guys through to 21, 22. You know, it looks long term. It looks like a long term vision. But the reality is, each summer, each transfer window, the resolve of these players to stay at the club is tested. Walker has been wonderful for Tottenham Hotspur, and at face value, it would be a loss to see him sold. But the reality is, if Pochettino is looking and thinking, well, if I have to get rid of one player this summer and generate 50, 60 million for him, at least I've got Kieran Trippier to fit straight into the team. But again, it comes back to the contracts. I mean, I personally find it remarkable that Pochettino would like to sign, for example, Wilfred Zaha, but the contract that Spurs would be willing to offer Zaha is less money than Palace would offer him. I mean, this is Crystal Palace, who might not even be in the Premier League next season. And that just sums up where they are. I actually think that Daniel Levy's got it right. I think it's everything about that is admirable, but it's finite. It's got a ceiling. Mm. And if everybody else is competing at a higher level in terms of wages...
And you know the other thing, if you were a selling club or you have selected a man to sell, if you look at the chaos at Manchester City and the rebuilding needed there and the available cash... And somebody like Pep Guardiola looking for right back and left back desperately, you've just got the blinding deal to be done because he may be surplus to Tottenham if he wants to force it. Mm. And then you've got a club with shed loads of money, you can force the price up. Yeah, so, I mean, that almost becomes a no-brainer for them all. And everybody thinks they're happy, but it's Manchester City who are going to be paying top dollar all the time.
Yeah. Now, at least Spurs have got a plan. You can't say the same thing about Arsenal, it seems to me. They are all over the shop, aren't they?
Well, it's just a state of limbo that we've had all season. Actually, not just one season, we're going back 4 or 5 years probably. The same old problems, the same old issues. I think the contractual situation with Ozil and Sanchez has obviously held the limelight, likewise with Wenger, but the reality is the club's sort of been meandering for a while. They have abject results. They get battered at Selhurst Park. Then they have a little revival, a great win in the Cup semi-final, you know, you think, oh, well, they're going to kick on now. And then they get outclassed, outmanoeuvred, thrashed at Tottenham Hotspur. That was a 2-0 thrashing. And at least in some ways now, it looks as if they're going to be out the top four and something has to change. Because that is a major change for them. They're used to competing in Europe. They're used to having that to fall back on every time. And now they've got to adjust. They've got to see where they go from there. It'll ask proper questions at the club.
But can it change? Because I watched Wenger quite closely at White Hart Lane, and you know we're used to his almost like Basil Fawlty-esque gestures, and he was obviously consumed with frustration, and he took it out on Steve Bould, who basically was just took it.
Yeah.
Now that contrast of a man consumed by his own frustrations and not seeking answers but just venting. With Pochettino talking quietly with his coaches, getting an idea of some sort of cohesive plan for a game, that's really damning to me.
Mm. But don't you think, Mike, there have been two dominant managers of the last 25 years in English football, Sir Alex Ferguson and this is the word he always used to use, the control he had at Manchester United, which took him 10 years to achieve, but where the board were listening to him, basically wanting to do what his vision was. And Arsene Wenger, with all he's achieved at Arsenal, and for many years, we've got to salute the work he did and the vision he had for it. But when there was an award, there was a presentation, rather, to Fergie when he was retiring, there was a leading light in the LMA made a speech. And it was Howard Wilkinson made a speech, and he came out with a line, and I just thought, that is spot on, the insight. And he said this, he said, Alex Ferguson's been the successful manager, but does he take every training session and do all the coaching with that team? No, but he knows a man who can, and has had a succession of be it assistant managers mm-hmm. or coaches who he's trusted to work with them. And part of the churn with that is different things going on with it. Does he do all the nutrition, the diet? No. But he knows people who can, and whatever the latest sports science is, they've always been brought in. And without a doubt, at the top of this pyramid at Manchester United was one man, and things were going to him to the point that you could argue taking him out caused a problem. Mm. But everybody knew where they were reporting, and he knew what they had to do. For me, one of the issues at Arsenal, including the Arsene Wenger being asked to give his confirmation of the appointment of a chief executive in Ivan Gazidis, is that Arsene almost has had too much control, and that the whole thing is just Arsene stepping in to do it. Arsene speaking that I am going to control this. And I think that has begun to unravel for them, and they need to come up with a new blueprint.
Mm. It's a strange game, management. If you look at David Moyes, his career has almost been fractured irrevocably by the one thing that he wanted more than anything else, the job at Man United. Mm-hmm. Where does this leave him, Sunderland's relegation?
I imagine asking questions of himself and asking whether he wants to go into the Championship. People say that he's done it in the Championship before, but he's never taken a team out of the Championship. And you have to go back a long way to Preston, early 2000s, to his time there. And the division has changed quite a bit since then. And moreover, that club is an absolute mess. I mean, it's in limbo in terms of the ownership. Have they got saleable assets? Jordan Pickford. They won't get very much money for Jermaine Defoe.
Kone, maybe.
Kone, he'll move on. But the debt level of debt, you're not going to eat into that. It's not as if suddenly Ellis Short's going to turn around and say, OK, like Newcastle, you can generate some money and you can spend it, and the money will go straight into clearing some of the debt, I'd imagine. It's hard to see how they have a resurgent season next year. So it's whether then David Moyes is whether he's willing to take on a job that's going to be, that it's a long, long, long-term job, and B, whether he feels that the supporters will even have him do that, because they've turned in recent weeks.
Mm. He's never been one of, you know, life's stand-up comedians, has he, David Moyes? But he's seemed especially defeatist, especially in the last sort of 6 months or so.
Yeah, I've got to say, I think the biggest issue there is how do you actually make a club a success when everybody knows the owner doesn't want to be there, yeah. It's for sale, and he's not going to make any commitment.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if I was advising David Moyes, I'd say, David, get out of there now, because unless there's new backers and they're going to transform the way Sunderland's being run, it's a no-hoper at the moment, because Ellis Short isn't going to make any commitment like that. I mean, to be fair, and I say, do I use the words to be fair when I'm talking about Mike Ashley? Maybe not, but Mike Ashley was a constant thread through that Newcastle thing. There was a stability, even if it's Mike Ashley you're working for. Ellis Short's made it absolutely clear he wants to cut and run and cut and run and cut. You know, he keeps saying this. Mm. He's no interest in it. So David Moyes would be wise getting out. And if we knew anybody being asked, do you want to come and be the Sunderland manager? Somebody will, because they always think they can work the miracle. But to me, it looks a nightmare scenario for anybody until the ownership's resolved.
Yeah. But it's not set in stone that if you've got an owner wishing to sell, that the whole thing's going to collapse. You look at Hull. Now, they've lucked in with Marco Silva. There's still instability at that club. They still want to sell it.
Yeah.
Yet they've got a good chance of getting out of this, haven't they?
They've got a great chance of getting out of their current relegation issues, but whether they've got a great chance long-term if the instability remains at the top is another thing. And they may have another, year next year.
It always comes round to the debate of manager of the year and things like that. And you look at, obviously, Conte, of what he's achieved at Chelsea, isn't it? And you look at Sean Dyche, you keep him, Burnley up would be the sort of middle ground of, isn't this remarkable? You look at the guy at Hull and what's happened to him. I mean, they were absolute doomed, weren't they? You know, just written off and
sold
the chaos around.
Players when he came
absolutely.
In as well.
And then what he's done and this whole thing of still never having lost a home game. I mean, what intrigues me in that scenario now is if Hull and Swansea keep winning games, particularly this weekend, you can see a scenario where Crystal Palace get dragged back into this from being in a position where, what, maybe 1-2 weeks ago, everybody said, well done, Sam, Palace are safe, you know, you've cracked it. And yet, the way they keep going, there is still the hint that the two of them could get out, yeah.
The club you know well, Dom, What do you think?
I remember 1993, I'm afraid. Palace thought they did a lap of honour after their final home game of the season, going into the last week. They beat Ipswich. They were 7 points clear, and everything was rosy. I think seven points clear. And then Oldham then won at Aston Villa the next day. They won against Liverpool in midweek when Palace got what appeared like a creditable draw at Manchester City, and then it went wrong on the last day, and they got relegated with 49 points, which was enough to get into the Europa League pretty much this season. So look, I'm scarred by that for life, and I always will be. It's playing on people's nerves at Selhurst Park, I think. But the other way of looking at it is that their destiny is in their own hands. Hull and Swansea would prefer to be in Palace's position, 6 points clear, with three games to go, particularly with one of those matches against Hull City. Palace have got three opportunities to get it right. Swansea have got to win all their games, really, or at least get 7 points.
Yeah, because Hull have got Sunderland, which you pretty much think is a three-point banker for them. Swansea have got Everton.
Yes.
Tough to beat.
Absolutely. The Everton one at the moment. I always think, if you look at it as a football fan, you'd actually say at the end of the season, if you're not Arsenal, Man United, Man City this year with all the Pep hype and they've had the view, we're going to win the league, we're going to win this, we're going to do it, and there's a disappointment. I think if you were some of the other clubs, you'd be looking, have we made progress? Can you actually see we're getting better? And I think Everton, under Ronald Koeman, especially, the home form have been great until the weekend. I think Everton fans believe that they can see this. There's a transition, but they're getting better. Now, the intriguing thing is so much of it has been based on really playing at home. Some of the away games, be it the recent 0-0 at West Ham, have been pretty dire. So Everton at Goodison are one prospect, and if you're down in the bottom four, playing Everton on your home patch is different. So I think that's then, as we know, the issue is Hull don't get every game at home, because the Hull home form suggests, even the other week when they had 10 men and winning, is astonishing.
And Hull's, it'll come down to that Palace Hull game, I think, which is the penultimate weekend, and that is a game that Palace will look at and think they can get out of it, and Hull will think if we can win there, then we may well be above Crystal Palace at that point. Mm. In which case, they're laughing. Because they've got Spurs on the last day, which isn't easy.
Yeah, what about Swansea in terms of Paul Clement? Mm. Seasons hinge on big decisions by boards. If they'd have had the foresight to go straight to Paul Clement instead of going to Bob Bradley, would they be in this mess?
Personally, I don't think they would. I think Clement does a lot right. He's a very good coach. I think he's still learning in terms of the managerial front, and I think he was shocked by that six-game winless run with only 1 point in that time at home to Middlesbrough, and that sort of came out of the blue because they looked as if they turned the corner. Mm. And I think that was more of a reflection of the playing squad and a playing squad that I think is actually not being good enough. I think Clement could have done with a bit more investment possibly in January. And if he'd been given that time, if he'd had the sort of time that Bradley had to assess what he had, what he'd inherited, and then could add more in January, I think they would have been fine, because they've got players like people like Sigurdsson just make a massive difference. Mm. It's not as if Sigurdsson's been injured at any point. Yeah. He's played and he's excelled throughout, and it's been deficiencies at the back. It's been a lack of options up front as well. When Llorente's out, they're blunted, and I think he would have addressed that in January. But I do think that even if they do go down, and it's no guarantee that they will, I think if they stick with Clement, I think he will get them playing the type of football they want to play, and he stands a great chance of bringing them straight back up.
And he's had a fantastic apprenticeship at the biggest clubs. Mm. Which brings us on, as a final point, to the Champions League again. Mm. This is the business end of the tournament. Who do you see going through to the final, both of you?
I see Real Madrid getting through that. I can see reasons why they won't, but I'll go Real Madrid, Juventus in the final, and I see Juventus winning it.
I'll go Atletico Madrid, Juventus final, but Juve winning it.
I'm with Dom. Max Allegri is under contract at Juve until 2020. I think he'll win the Champions League and maybe, just maybe, end up at Arsenal. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.